also through a series of policies that make life extremely difficult for Palestinians, so they leave. Forced expulsion of Palestinians, that's going on right now in the West Bank, it's happened in East Jerusalem. So that's how Israel, through a series of policies, seeks to try to preserve a Jewish majority. No state has the right to do that.
Really? Not even all the Arab states?
No, if they are enacting laws that discriminate against people on the basis of their... On the basis of their religion, of their ethnicity, I would stand against any system of ethno-nationalism wherever it exists. There is a between people across the world at the moment who are trying to promulgate ideologies of ethno-nationalism. That's why the Minister of Diaspora Affairs in Israel has just invited Tommy Robinson to make
it. All right, Ben Jamal, I'm afraid I had a lot more to ask you, but... you walked down memory lane and too many cases meant I couldn't get to it. Maybe you'll come back and we can try again with more time. That's Ben Jamal there, Director of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. That's it for me today. I'll be back at 1 p.m. tomorrow. Next up on Times Radio, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Andrew, and a very good afternoon. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio until 4.
Coming up on the programme today, as former England rugby captain Lewis Moody reveals he has motor neuron disease, we'll look at a potential link between athletes and the condition. Smaller crowds at the Tory conference this year, can the party survive? We'll speak to David Cameron's former advisor. Our money man Adam Shaw will tell us whether we could be headed to a market crash. We're going to reflect on the life and times of Jilly Cooper with the journalist Pandora Sykes, and that interview does include an anecdote about a see-through shirt and a snog. And after 3:30, I'll be speaking to Taylor Swift's former manager on the early signs of her global domination.
Let's get the news at 2. Here's Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Queen has led tributes to the best-selling novelist Dame Jilly Cooper, who's died at the age of 88, describing her as a legend and wonderfully witty and compassionate friend. The writer, known for her books including Riders, Rivals and Polo, died unexpectedly yesterday morning after a fall, with her children Felix and Emily saying it had come as a complete shock. She spoke to Times Radio a couple of years ago and said politicians could be a bit over-friendly.
I used to live in a flat in Westminster. The MPs were always ringing up and saying, just come back from the house, darling. Just come back from the house. Come and have a drink. I've had a pasting over the milk bill. Come and have a drink. And they were all randy as anything in those days too.
Did you have any liaisons with these gentlemen? No.
I'm a good girl.
The Shadow Chancellor, Mel Stride, has pledged that the Tories would scrap business rates on leisure and hospitality sector if they win the next election. The large audiences at the Labour Party conference haven't been seen in Manchester as the party struggles to remain relevant with Reform beating them in the polls. When Kayman Badenoch became leader of the party 11 months ago, the Conservatives were at 26%, vying for first place with Labour. Now they stand at around 16%, struggling to avoid fourth place behind the Lib Dems. Shadow Business Minister Harriet Baldwin recognises there's a lot of work to do with the public since the election results last year.
They are not yet ready, I think this is clear, to say we got rid of you last year, you're immediately the solution to our problems today. So we need to do the hard yards and the groundwork over these next 3 years. And I'm really, really encouraged by what we're hearing in Manchester. And I've been speaking to a wide range of different businesses here who have all said that they really are being held back by the current government.
Two teenagers have been jailed for killing a 15-year-old boy in a gang-related machete attack. Dejon Campbell was ambushed in Woolwich in September last year. Following a trial at the Old Bailey, 18-year-old Imlay Duo was found guilty of murder and sentenced to life with a minimum term of 21 years. His co-accused Marco Ballatz, who's 19, was convicted of manslaughter and admitted drugs offences. He was handed 11 years in custody. Grace Amali Kumar, one of the victims of the Nottingham stabbing 2 years ago, has been posthumously awarded a George Medal for bravery. She tried to pull apart the attacker from her friend Barnaby when she could have run away. Her brother James says it comes as no surprise.
We often use the phrase putting your life on the line as an exaggeration and figure of speech, but my sister truly lived those words.
Three men have been jailed after their roles in violent disorder outside a hotel housing asylum seekers in Essex. Martin Pegram, Dean Smith and Stuart Williams had previously pleaded guilty. They were sentenced to Chelmsford Crown Court for a combined 6 years and 4 months in prison. Former England rugby union captain Lewis Moody says he's focused on staying positive after being diagnosed with motor neurone disease. It's the same illness that's claimed the lives of fellow rugby players Doddy Weir and Rob Burrow. His former World Cup winning teammate from 2003, Will Greenwood, is sure Moody will now do his best to raise money and awareness to fight the disease.
His nickname was Mad Dog. He will go hard at this and he will find something that he can still do that will require immense physical and human endurance, and he will laugh at it and he will come out the other side and say it was just a walk in the park. That's what he always did.
Thousands of Jet2 staff are in line for a portion of a £58 million payout. The company says more than 5,700 workers will receive payments after joining its employee share plan scheme. Workers who joined the inaugural programme in 2022 will now receive money after it matured at the start of October. And for a roundup of news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. Hope you're fit and well this rather glorious Monday afternoon. We're here until 4 o'clock. Lots to squeeze in. We will be talking about Lewis Moody, who has announced that MND diagnosis. We're going to talk to a researcher in a moment or two. We'll also have the journalist and writer Pandora Sykes paying tribute to her literary heroine, Jilly Cooper, who has died at the age of 88. A bit of tumbleweed at the Tory conference. Honestly, can they come back from this? More later. And France is looking for its sixth prime minister in 5 years. Where does this turmoil leave President Macron, who appears to be the lamest of all presidential ducks right now? And are we on the verge of a stock market collapse? A cheering contribution at around 3:45 from our personal finance guru, Adam Shaw. That, of course, is unless the answer is no, we're not on the verge of a stock market collapse. And we'll also talk about the winners of the Nobel Prize for Medicine, three people who've done pioneering work on how the immune system works, and an interesting guest after 3:30. With a tale to tell from the world of showbiz. Who is it?
Well, it's Rick Barker, and he was Taylor Swift's manager from 2007 to 2008. So not a long time in her career, but an important time, because it was when she was really gearing up in Nashville to take herself out of just being a country singer and into the kind of beginnings of the stratosphere that we now find her in. So if all of the seeds of life are sown in childhood, I think Rick Barker has definitely seen those seeds sprouting. Have I stretched that analogy far enough? I think so.
Blooming marvellous, I thought it was.
Thank you.
So we'll hear from him after 3:30 this afternoon. And before we talk about Lewis Moody and motor neurone disease, what are the most read stories on the Times website?
In at number three, Sebastian Lecornu resigns as French Prime Minister. We'll have more on that one later in the show. That is the fifth Prime Minister that France has had in just 2 years. The second most read story, Angela Rayner unlikely to face investigation over car use. The former Deputy Prime Minister had allowed her partner to use her taxpayer-funded vehicle to move some boxes. And the most read piece on the Times website is about the death of Jilly Cooper. She had a fall and she has died aged 88. We interviewed her in 2023 around the release of what would be her final book. It was about the world of football. It was called Tackle! Exclamation mark. And she told us how a lost manuscript was a blessing in her career.
No, I'm just very, very, very grateful for it. But I mean, an awful thing that happened was that years ago I wrote a book called Riders. But 10 years before, I had written about 100,000 words of it. I took it out to lunch to do some corrections on the bus.
Oh, I think I will.
Yes, awful. You can imagine this. And so I had a lovely lunch. I can't even remember Freudian who I had lunch with, but then we got a bit pissed. And I came and I got back to Putney and it had gone. So I lost the manuscript. Can you imagine the horror?
No. Oh, that's terrible.
But it took 10 years later, I finished it, and it was a much better book than it would have been. So I've been very, very touching, but I've been very lucky in life. It was much better later.
Yeah, but you're also very good at what you do.
So it's not just luck, is it?
That's very kind, very kind. I work quite hard.
So Jilly Cooper, they're talking to us a couple of years ago. I would imagine that a lunch with Jilly Cooper would have been a rather fantastic event. And of course, you'd lose everything on the bus on the way home. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe. And if you're already a digital subscriber to the papers, then you get access to a whole range of newsletters, including the politics newsletter. It's now emailed every morning, 7 days a week. So if you want to wake up, ingest it and just be the most informed person right from the get-go every morning, just log into your Times account and head to My Newsletters.
Now, the former England player Lewis Moody has revealed that he has motor neurone disease. He was a noted rugby union player, of course, now age 47, part of the Rugby World Cup winning team back in 2003. Now, fellow rugby players Doddy Weir and Rob Burrow have died from MND in recent years. Here is Lewis Moody speaking to the BBC.
I think it's safe to say it came as a fairly sizable shock to all of us, but I think over the last couple of months, in particular the last couple of weeks, we've had this sort of lingering in the back of our minds, and this sort of news, and until we were actually told on the day in the appointment, I don't think it really sunk in. But in myself, I feel absolutely fine.
That's Lewis Moody. Well, we can talk now to the sports broadcaster Jill Douglas, who is a patron of the charity My Name's Doddy Foundation, founded by the player Doddy Weir. And I know, Jill, you were a friend of Doddy Weir. How were you when you heard about Lewis Moody? And what impact do you think his very brave public announcement of his diagnosis is going to have?
Well, it was heartbreaking news. I know Lewis, watched him play many, many times, interviewed him and multiple occasions, and have been with him at many, many charity events over the years. I was there in 2003 when he won the World Cup with England. You know, an uncompromising player, brave, just the most amazing character, and what he's done since he gave up rugby as well, just an extraordinary character. So it was heartbreaking to hear his news, because I know what he faces in the next few years. He and his family, it's the toughest of diagnoses. I mean, it really is a brutal disease. And of course, my thoughts were immediately for him and for his family and for those close to them, because I know it's going to be very difficult for them to process over the next few weeks. It was a terrible diagnosis for Doddy and Ed Slater and others, anyone who's been given this diagnosis. And my heart just goes out for him and his family, because it's going to be a tough few months ahead. And to hear him talk so candidly about how he felt and how he's approaching life now was quite overwhelming.
He's only 47, and he knows, and you know, and lots of people listening will know, that the progress of this disease can be heartbreakingly rapid. And the impact on your physical capabilities so considerable and so quickly. So is there anything approaching a bright side? Can we at least acknowledge that now we know as a population more about MND, but are we any closer to finding a cure for it?
Huge amounts of effort are going into better understanding the causation of MND and how we can find effective treatments and maybe one day a cure. And that's what My Name's Doddy Foundation has been laser focused on since we began. Doddy felt it was absolutely unacceptable that when he was given his diagnosis, he really felt as though there was no hope. He wasn't offered any treatment other than something that had been licensed in 1996, which could potentially add a few months to your life. So I think when Doddy had his diagnosis, we felt as though there was very little in the way of hope, because perhaps the investment wasn't there and the focus wasn't there. In the last few years, for a variety of reasons, I think breakthroughs in stem cell technology, gene therapy, drug repurposing, there is a sense that we are shifting in the right direction, and there is a sense of hope. And I think it's right to be positive looking ahead. Our foundation has invested more than £20 million into really important research. More money is needed, obviously. We keep saying it's not a disease that's incurable, it's just underfunded. And I think if we really focus our minds on it, because it could be the breakthrough that we need that will help other neurological diseases as well. That said, at the moment, there is very little by way of treatments for people, depending on what type of MND they're diagnosed with, whether it's if they suffer from a specific gene or if it's sporadic, which is what the vast majority of people are suffering from.
So superficially, I think you couldn't blame a member of the public for thinking, well, there's clearly a link between high impact sports like rugby and MND, is there?
There is nothing proven at this time. There's been various studies which maybe look at a correlation between the two, but not a causation. More needs to be done to investigate what causes motor neuron disease. We don't really understand the disease as well as we should. We are understanding it better as time goes on and as we learn through further research. My husband had more concussions than Doddy. He was a teammate of his. He hasn't developed MND. Doddy himself never believed that it was his rugby that led to him receiving this terrible diagnosis. But we need to do more to find out about why we're hearing anecdotally about people who perform at elite level in sport are being diagnosed. It's not just rugby. We're looking at people in football and other sports as well. But if it was directly linked to head injury, we would expect perhaps more people with MND coming from the world of boxing, for instance.
Yes, OK. And I suppose you still see footballers heading footballs. But it happens right across the game of football. And have there been noted footballers, or indeed any footballers, who've got MND relatively recently, as far as you know?
Yes, several right. Elite footballers, which is, heartbreaking to hear as well. I mean, we don't want to hear of anybody being given this terrible diagnosis. Because they are footballers, rugby players, they tend to be in the news, cricketers as well.
Yeah.
And so we should be cautious before we start speculating on linkage. Whereas, in my time with the foundation, I've talked to so many people who've been living with MND, and they are farmers and tradesmen and teachers, and some of them are triathletes, and some of them work, do marathon running. And so I think rather than speculate about links, we need to do more to find out what causes the disease. And we shouldn't perhaps leap to conclusions without having the science behind us.
Thank you. Really appreciate your time. That's the sports broadcaster Jill Douglas, who's a patron of the charity My Name's Doddy Foundation. Let's bring in Dr. Jonathan Cooper-Knock from the University of Sheffield. And Dr. Cooper-Knock, I think I'm right in saying that your work has found a link between the sort of people predisposed to taking up strenuous exercise and MND. Now, is that correct? Because I really want to be careful about what exactly it is you've discovered.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. So my work is focused on sort of causes of motor neuron disease, trying to understand that. And, and I think as has been highlighted in the conversation, there's been people have tied a line between sort of exercise and motor neuron disease. But clearly the vast majority of people who do exercise at high levels, at any level, don't have motor neuron disease. These are some of the most healthy people alive. Exercise is really, really good for you. So my work and the work I do in collaboration with sort of, other people at the University of Sheffield, funded by My Name's Doddy, actually, is trying to understand, who is at risk of that? Who is potentially at risk of sort of, bad things with lots of exercise? Is it everybody who, can we then sort of identify those people and prevent that harm? And so what we've done is we look at that and we find that the very highest, extreme levels of exercise in very specific people could potentially be linked to risk of motor neuron disease. And that we think, those very specific people perhaps have a molecular defect, which might in some way, I describe it as almost take the brakes off. It could almost help the motor neurons fire, at that extreme level, but it could also perhaps then put them at slightly increased risk. So we're trying to think about how we could approach that with a molecular level treatment. Does that make sense?
It does. But I suppose I want to make it clear, as you've already done, that lots of exercise doesn't make you more likely to get MND. In fact,
no.
Regular exercise for all of us is without question a good thing.
Yeah, Absolutely. So I think that's really, really important. I wouldn't, you know, I'm a clinician as well. You know, and I never, ever, ever tell anybody to reduce their level of exercise, because reducing exercise is always bad for us. You know, I think that's very clear. So I think probably the best evidence for this. So there was a study from a researcher called Fang in Sweden, looking at the Blasepet ski race. So this is a cross-country ski race, more than 1,000 people a year. It's a really big thing. If you're in the top 5% of that race, then your risk of motor neuron disease is about 4 times the background population. Okay. Yeah. Still, most people in that 5% don't get disease. If you're in the rest of the field, your risk is about half. So for the vast majority of people doing a moderate level of exercise, or even, you know, what we'd consider quite a lot of exercise, but not the most extreme, extreme levels, then actually perhaps there's a reduced risk of motor neuron disease. Is that clear?
Yes, but I guess, again, I used the word superficial when I was talking to Jill Douglas. I think for perhaps lots of us who will look at this story and remember Lewis Moody in his World Cup winning pomp, will think that there has to be a link between high impact, high octane sporting achievement and this particularly cruel disease. But you are, I think, as keen as Jill was to make it clear that the truth is we don't know yet.
Most people who have done that level of exercise are some of the healthiest people on the planet. I think that's the key, isn't it? Is that, you know, until you can say, you know, which people are potentially at risk, then, you know, we should all attain, you know, we should all want to do as much exercise as we can. And, you know, and my work and our work in Sheffield is trying to sort of, you know, find out who would be at risk, and then we can sort of allow people to make informed decisions. But yeah, and unfortunately at the moment, where we're not with the research, we're starting to understand links, but it's got to be about individuals, not groups.
I mean, I have to say, I can't think at the moment of a high profile female sports person who has got MND. But we do know, don't we, that more men than women get it anyway. That's correct, isn't it?
That's absolutely true. So yeah, so about 60-40 males, females. But again, in our research, actually, it was the link appeared to be in males doing the highest, most extreme levels of exercise, and not in females. We didn't identify any link in females. However, you know, I think there were less females doing the high. You know, we're talking extreme levels of exercise here. There were just in our research in the group we were studying, we had less power to do that analysis, and so we're not sure at the moment whether that's a power thing or you know, we're still understanding that.
Thank you very much indeed. I really appreciate it, but I think it's such a sad thing, not least because so many of us remember, and the cricketer as well, David Lawrence, Sid Lawrence, remember him as well playing, and you remember Lewis playing, and you remember Doddy Weir playing. There's just a particular cruelty in seeing these competitive athletic figures struck down by this absolutely awful ailment. Thank you very much indeed. That was Dr. Jonathan Cooper-Knock from the University of Sheffield, and you also heard from Jill Douglas from the My Name is Doddy Foundation.
It's 21 minutes past two. Coming up, with 1,000 stranded climbers needing to be rescued on Mount Everest, why are people so obsessed with scaling the world's tallest mountain? This is Jane and Fee, and you're listening to Times Radio.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Stig is on his way to Manchester. He'll be interviewing Kemi Badenoch on the programme tomorrow, so we'll bring you all the latest from the party conference. Plus, William Hague and Kezia Dugdale will be here from 9 to go through the stories of the day. And Ben Elton, actor Ben Elton, will be here for a little bit of star power.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel. Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Hi, babe. Yeah, mad day. So, do you fancy staying in tonight instead? Delivery fee is now from 99p on the Mackey's app, and we can get a free chicken Big Mac if we spend £15. So, you in? Of course you are.
Exclusively on the McDonald's app. £15 spend only on main day food and drink via delivery until the 19th of October. 18 plus. Service fee and small order fee may apply. Participating restaurants. Serving times and T's and C's apply.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
Ever wondered what power is? Power is transforming the sun into your own energy source. Power is getting energy companies to pay you. Power is enjoying your morning coffee, knowing you created the energy to make it. Well, you and the colossal ball of fire in the sky. Because with solar panels from Hive, the sun works for you. Hive, know your power. May not cover all electricity usage, roof and weather dependent. Paid for surplus requires eligible SET tariff.
Imagine a delicious patty nestled between two buns with cheese and ketchup. It's not a burger. That patty is actually sausage, which makes this a sandwich. A breakfast sausage sandwich. The new £1.99 sausage sandwich from McDonald's. Made with RSPCA assured pork. Until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary. Upcharges and fees apply to delivery. Subject to availability.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Oh, that's new and nice, isn't it? Now, a rescue operation is underway on the slopes of Mount Everest after hundreds of climbers were stranded in a blizzard. The eastern slopes of the mountain in Tibet are thought to be the worst hit, with hikers heading to the area for China's National Day holiday. With increasing fears of over-tourism in the Himalayas, why do such inhospitable places exert such a pull? Well, let's talk to Dr. Dawn Hollis, who is a historian of mountains and mountaineering, but joins us from an office today, I think, Dr. Hollis. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm in Crail in Scotland.
Okay, right. So at sea level, let's just say.
Yes, very much at sea level, yes. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how you end up being a historian of mountains.
Well, I guess I started out by being quite fascinated by mountains as objects to climb as a young person. And then as I became very interested in history, I started to wonder what the history was before you got mountaineering in its modern sense. And I became very interested because there was a lot of history. A lot of historians said, well, no one liked mountains before mountaineers decided that they were going to go stick a flag on the top of them, which struck me as a little bit of a surprising statement in a way. And the more I researched, the more I discovered that was actually untrue and that there were a lot of different ways that people went to the mountains before mountaineering, but that from the 1800s onwards, there was this kind of new way of interacting with the mountain landscape, which is dominated by mountaineering, by sport, by this sort of desire to challenge yourself by climbing to the top of a mountain.
So those first people who decided that they wanted to climb to the top of a mountain, are they part of the kind of Victorian band of explorers? Are they doing it as part of conquest? Are they men who wanted to show off? What was that impetus?
Well, I think that people often climbed up mountains, I think, in the past and long before we started recording it. They didn't necessarily want to get to the very summit, and the desire to get to the very top of a mountain, I suppose the first person, well, I don't like to say first because there'll always be a medieval historian who'll say you're wrong. But, you know, one key example is the first ascent of Mont Blanc, which was driven by Horace Benedict de Saussure, who wanted to find out what it was like at the top of a mountain. You know, what could you observe about the world? So it was kind of a scientific drive. And then in the decades following that, it kind of got taken over by the Alpine Club, by this kind of somewhat imperialistic mission to, yes, there was, a masculine element of sort of showing national and masculine pride by getting to the top of a mountain. And that then became very much a kind of a project of the mountaineers, of the Alpine clubs who claim the mountain peaks for the relevant countries that they belonged to.
And can you just put into context for us how busy Everest is now compared to how busy Everest would have been, say, 100 years ago?
Well, I mean, the first attempt at ascent of Everest were in 1921. And for the first 30 or so years of Everest, until you could only one attempt could be made on the mountain each year during those first three decades. So, you know, when Hilary and Tenzing finally climbed Everest in the 1950s, that was a big moment because it was a very frightening moment for Britain because that was the last time they'd be on the mountain. They'd got a permit for the mountain for several years. So if it had to be then, or it would be another country that did it in a subsequent year. So, you know, compare that to today, you know, you'd have one attempt with one team. And now, you know, I don't know the exact numbers of how many are attempting Everest each year, but base camp is, you know, a very busy place.
Yeah.
And you have big commercial expeditions taking people up. Whereas I'd say that in sort of early era, they were kind of professional mountaineers.
Sure. And when we talk about this, Dr. Hollis, and I think we still ignore the people who make it possible, don't we? They are the Sherpas, they are the local people. And in these cases of extremists, which is what the climbers are facing at the moment, you know, they're stuck up there. Many of them have got hypothermia. They've been taken by surprise by the weather. They are relying on those people who we don't know the names of them. We don't know much about their families, much about who they are. But they're the ones who make all of this possible. And it's poor that that kind of ignorance still exists, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think there's a very, very long history from sort of the first. So one of the first pieces of research I did into mountains was looking at how the 1920s expeditions, how they, the people, the British people on them viewed the Tibetans who helped them get up the mountain. And it was, there was all these different ways in which they kind of dismissed the experience and capabilities that these people had. And they wouldn't have been going up there if it hadn't been for them. I mean, I think what's quite interesting about this example to what's happening at the moment is that it's domestic tourism rather than, you know, it's not this. These are lots of people coming from China going to be in the Himalayan valleys rather than people from further afield going to climb Everest. And so maybe it's a bit more comparable to sort of people going up into the highlands and then relying on somewhat on the mountain rescue to come and get them out of a scrape when they haven't really thought about or necessarily anticipated the way weather can change so extremely quickly in the mountains.
But it's still quite poor, isn't it, that we don't know many of these people's names or, you know, give them the kind of hero status that they deserve. Do you think that this kind of culture of wanting to climb mountains just continues? It just grows and grows? Is it a passing phenomena?
So I think that there has been a sort of, it does seem to keep growing and it does seem to keep getting more and more extreme in the, you know, originally, you know, you could claim honour by, you know, this is what the early Alpine Club did. They claimed honour for the country by going and making the first ascents of mountains in the Alps. And then the mountains in the Alps all ran out. They climbed them all. And then you have to start, you know, being the fastest person to climb a mountain or the oldest or the youngest. And then you get, you know, increasingly excessive kind of challenges like, you know, can you be the person who climbs all seven summits as fast as possible, which then has, you know, enormous kind of environmental ramifications if you're essentially, you know, flying from place to place to knock them all off as quickly as possible. And then I think that what you may be seeing here in this particular case is the rise then of, you know, the people who are stuck on Everest right now are not mountaineers. They are people, they're trekkers, they're hikers. And I think that there's then this sort of, there's been an increase in a desire to be out in nature, to be out in these mountain environments, maybe exceeds the capacity of those environments to support those numbers of people.
Yeah.
And you probably see that worldwide.
For sure. I was rather hoping that you'd say, no, we'll all pass through this because all of those very competitive people now just want to go to space and we could just export them to a different planet and see whether they can get up a mountain there. Lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much. That's Dr. Dawn Hollis, who is a historian of mountains and mountaineering.
Now, in the next half an hour, we are going to talk to the author and journalist Pandora Sykes, paying tribute to the great Jilly Cooper, who has died at the age of 88, and we'll celebrate as well the winners of the Nobel Prize for Medicine. It's Times Radio. It's just after 2:30. Here are the headlines. Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Queen has led tributes to the best-selling novelist Dame Jilly Cooper, who's died at the age of 88, describing her as a legend and wonderfully witty and compassionate friend. The official spokesman for the Prime Minister has praised her contribution to British culture and the delight she inspired. The writer, known for books including Riders, Rivals and Polo, died unexpectedly yesterday morning after a fall, with her children Felix and Emily saying it had come as a complete shock. The Conservative Party says it'll abolish business rates for high street shops and pubs if they win the next election. Shadow Chancellor Sir Mel Stride says his party would cut £47 billion from public spending. He also proposed a £5,000 rebate of national insurance to those in a first full-time job to help them buy a home. Reem Ibrahim from the Institute of Economic Affairs explains what younger voters want to see.
Housing is number one, I think. I also think work. They want to work for themselves. They don't want the government to tax huge amounts of their own money. But actually, it's really about aspiration.
The mother of murdered teenager Dejun Campbell's called her son's killers pathetic cowards following their sentencing. The 15-year-old was stabbed to death with a machete in Woolwich in southeast London in September last year. Imre Due received 21 years in prison for murder, while Marco Balatz got 9 years for his manslaughter. Greta Thunberg's been deported from Israel after being detained when a Gaza-bound aid flotilla was intercepted last week. Meanwhile, representatives from Hamas and Israel are in Egypt for indirect talks on how to achieve peace in the enclave. One of the victims of the Nottingham attack in June 2023 has been awarded the George Medal for her exceptional courage. Grace O'Malley Kumar was stabbed to death while trying to save her friend Barnaby. And former England rugby union captain and 2003 World Cup winner Lewis Moody has been diagnosed with motor neurone disease. In a post on social media, the 47-year-old says he feels fit and well and is focused on staying positive and living life. Fellow rugby players Doddy Weir and Rob Burrow have died from MND in recent years. For a roundup of news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar, and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programs and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
They're bubbly, they're fuzzy, and they're ruddy delicious.
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees. Conditions apply.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wix, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
Yes, Times Radio. We're here until 4 o'clock. John Pienaar is at the Tory Party conference. We're talking about this, aren't we, after 3 o'clock. If you look at some of the images, not huge numbers there, but John will tell you exactly what the atmosphere is like. You've seen those images, haven't you, Fee?
Well, I have, and I think that the show business phrase we'd use is tickets are still available.
It does look
that Andy way. Street, former mayor of the West Midlands, is going to join John. Bob Blackman, chair of the 1922 committee, and the former Justice Secretary, Robert Buckland, all our guests at the Times Radio coming live from the Tory Party conference show that follows us.
Yeah, that's all very clear. So John Pienaar with you from Manchester between 4 o'clock and seven here on Times Radio. Now, the discovery of how the immune system attacks hostile infections, but not the body itself, has won three remarkable researchers the Nobel Prize for Medicine for this year. They are Americans Mary Brunko and Fred Ramsdell, who will share winnings of almost £900,000 with a Japanese scientist, Shimon Sakaguchi. Now, the Times science writer Tom Whipple is able to talk to us now. So, Tom, in layperson's terms, what have these remarkable people discovered?
So the immune system is how we fight things off. And one of the biggest problems, it's a hugely powerful system that we have, but one of the biggest problems is how do you stop it attacking yourself? And actually, one of the biggest problems we have as humans is what happens when it does attack you in autoimmune diseases, because that's what's going on. This is the system, one of the systems, they discovered one of the systems by which we have these things called regulator T cells. So T cells are one of your immune attacky things, if that's layperson enough. the regulator cells stop the other T cells that attack you. And this is really important for stopping the autoimmune diseases. But it's also important because sometimes you kind of want them to attack you. Cancer is essentially your cells going wrong. And one of the ways in which cancer flies under the radar is that it doesn't get attacked by your immune system. So knowing this process and knowing when you want more of these regulator T cells to stop you attacking yourself and stop you getting all these autoimmune conditions, and actually when you might want fewer of them because you want to be able to attack your own cancer tumour, is really important. So this is, you know, another, unsurprisingly, another extremely important advance given by the Nobel Committee. But I think we're going to be coming to these all week. So what I want to really flag about that is an area which has been quite disappointing. And that is, this was one of the worst performances I've seen by the Nobel Prize Committee in getting the researchers on the phone. Because one of the great dramas of the Nobel Prize is they have an hour to do it. They vote in the morning about who's going to get it, and then they have an hour to try to wake them up if they're in the States or get them. And they've had some real coups in the past. I think probably their finest hour was when they managed to get someone on a transatlantic flight. They got the captain of the plane to go out into the passengers, wake him up, and haul him into the cockpit so that he could receive a call from the Nobel Prize Committee. On this occasion, they were only able to rouse the Japanese researcher. The frankly feeble excuse that the two American researchers must have had their phones on silent.
I see. And what did that do to the atmosphere in the room, Tom?
Well, it was disappointing. We liked to have. We didn't have a sort of live reaction from them, and it is an amazing moment. You get the normally with big scientific prizes, they've known for months and they've been told you've got to keep secret about it, but you really get these people at the moment when they've pivoted from being essentially nobodies. I mean, I googled them, as everyone does immediately when this happens, and went to their Wikipedia page. Only one of them I found had a Wikipedia page, and it was about a paragraph. So they've gone from being utterly anonymous to now their life is going to completely pivot. You know, suddenly their university is going to think that they are the best thing in the world, quite possibly after years of being ignored. There was one of them who said, Andre Geim, I remember the University of Manchester Nobel laureate, who said he could finally get a parking space at his department. There was another year where one of the professors, she wasn't a professor, she finally got tenure when I think her university decided if Stockholm thinks she's good, maybe we should think she's good. So it is a marvellous moment. And I am hoping for the Nobel Committee to pull their finger out and get them live on the phone, bleary-eyed, 4 in the morning from California, telling us what a wonderful moment it is.
Why don't they warn people that they might want to keep their phone on, Tom?
Well, it's part of the mystique. And they do pretend they have decided on the morning. And I think there is an element that they've decided. I think it's probably a shortlist and they vote because they have everything ready to go in terms of all of the material telling us what these quite complex discoveries often are. But it's part of the law. And you speak to scientists who will say, you know, every year, because they know it's likely, and they'll sit there waiting for the Stockholm number to pop up on their mobile phone. But also, I've spoken to scientists who said that they get phone calls in this period from colleagues putting on a Swedish accent.
Oh, that's so childish. I must admit, I hadn't, until you mentioned all your anecdotal evidence, I hadn't realised what an impact it could have on people who, as you say, could have been labouring away in the shadows for decades only to get these fantastic changes to their professional lives. Do you, can you enter yourself or your work, or is it up to the Nobel authorities to discover what it is you've been doing?
I think the closest we've got to that is Donald Trump, who has quite publicly said, can I be shortlisted? And I think has been, because you get people submit. You submit to the Karolinska Institute, who are in charge of, they're not in charge of peace, they're in charge of the proper ones. And they then sort of accept nominations. And there are people who we know, it's a bit like a papal election. You sort of get it through sort of half-heard rumours. But there are people we know who've been nominated several times and not got it. So the rules are you're nominated, they then consider it, and only three people can ever share the prize, which is a bit of a problem because that's not actually how science is done. And you have to be alive, although there was one semi-recent in Nobel history, was in 2011, I think it was Ralph Steinman who got it. He got it posthumously because he had died 3 days earlier and the family hadn't announced it. And so they were sort of in the middle of grieving for their... he was an immunologist as well. And that his phone was still on, which tells you how much better phones were back in 2011. And they got a message that popped up on his BlackBerry saying that he won the Nobel Prize, which is a sort of lovely tale. But he's the only exception to the posthumous rule.
Now, two Americans are going to share the prize for medicine this year. We know that the Trump administration has, shall we say, a particular approach to science and to scientific funding. So might we not see very many American winners in the future?
This is the weird thing about the Nobel, in that actually you are rewarding people for work they did. I mean, I was going to say 10 years ago, but that's extremely rare. I can only remember two Nobels that went for works that recently, 20, 30, 40 years ago. So you're really getting this massive lag, because often these are discoveries that have to be really bedded in so you're sure that they're true and that they're valuable. We might well. The US has been the major funder of basic science research of the sort that wins the Nobels. But Trump won't be alive to see the sort of downfall of science in that sense. It will be happening long after he's dead. But this is also, in all seriousness, this is one of the things Britain often says we punch above our weight, and it'll be a strange Nobel season if one of the prizes this week doesn't go to a Brit. But what we have to remember is that is effectively rewarding Thatcherite policies on science, or people in that sort of area, because you've got to bed in the policy, it's got to produce the results, and then the things that you find out have to be shown. So inevitably, this is about older scientists and things that happened a long time ago.
Thank you very much, Tom. Tom Whipple on the Nobel Prize for Medicine, and we're going to have more on the Nobel Prizes during the course of the week. Do you remember when Doris Lessing got the Nobel Prize for Literature?
Yes.
She just got back from the shops.
Had she? I didn't remember that detail. But she deserved to get the prize.
She deserved to get it, but it was just her reaction was, oh, bloody hell. It was very sweet, and she sat on the steps and talked to reporters.
Have you just sworn on live radio?
I do apologise. It was only... I was impersonating the late Doris Lessing, so if anybody was offended, I'm extremely sorry.
Well, Simon's going to very much enjoy Tom Whipple's daily feature, Overblown Award, Just Get On With It.
Thanks for being on board, Simon. We appreciate it.
It's 0333 003 2353 this afternoon and every afternoon. Now, is the Conservative Party dead, and can Kemi Badenoch revive its corpse? Those are the questions on everybody's minds, if not their lips, at this week's party conference in Manchester, according to The Times' political editor, Stephen Swinford. On today's episode of The Story Podcast, he tells Luke Jones about the challenges facing the unpopular
popular leader and her embattled party.
If you talk to people in the city, they still talk to you with a bit of glee about the moron premium that Britain is suffering from. What does the moron premium mean? It means that when traders look at the UK, because of the actions that Liz Truss took in the mini-budget, when there was a kind of complete collapse in the financial markets, they believe that the UK is less predictable and valuable as a result. And it is much more volatile. The bond markets now go crazy with any kind of slight palpitation in policy. And that is a legacy of the Tories. That is an economic legacy that they are having to live down to this day. And the other point is a really simple one, which is obviously Liz Truss's premiership precipitated a situation where mortgages went up steeply. They went up dramatically. And it brought an early end. It would have ended anyway, but it brought a very early and abrupt end to the era of cheap fixed-term mortgages. And a lot of people have gone from, you know, seen their mortgages double. They're paying thousands of pounds more. And that has a long tail. And then there's the other issue, which is connected to this, which is on migration, which is Boris Johnson. So you have both Nigel Farage and Keir Starmer now talking about the Boris wave. And what they mean by that is that the post-Brexit migration policy that came in under Boris Johnson led to a huge surge in the levels of legal migration. And so we went from a Tory party that had committed to reducing net migration back in the day when I started out to hundreds of thousands, less than 100,000, I think it got beyond 700,000 at one point. And that is politically absolutely toxic. So they've got two really toxic legacies to deal with on their hands. One, the economy and what happened with Liz Truss, and two, migration. And both are being weaponized effectively by Labour and Reform. So that is going to take years to recover from that, because they're two really significant events. And Kemi Badenoch has apologised for that, right? She has said that this is legacy, it went wrong. But it's probably not enough. People are still feeling it. And that's the challenge, trying to get the forgiveness of voters.
Well, that is the Story podcast, just a tiny slice of it. Stephen Swinford in conversation with Luke Jones. You can get that wherever you get your podcasts from. Coming up, we're going to react a little bit more to the very sad news of the death of the author Gilly Cooper. It's coming up to 10 minutes to 3. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio. Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation, telling the stories that matter, alongside a world-class lineup of guests, experts and contributors. There's a merry band of erudite intellectuals who join us every evening, Michael Binion.
We had a very interesting meeting with the Russian Orthodox Patriarch.
Zoe Strimple.
There is real unease.
And Peter Hitchens, to name a few.
This is war, for goodness sake. Nobody tells the truth about what's going on.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio. Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
Those who are curious feel an urge to travel, to explore the world. At Viking, we create voyages for the thinking person, because travel enriches the mind and connects cultures in meaningful ways. With small, modern, all-veranda ocean ships that were designed to bring you closer to the destination, discover the world's iconic cities and quaint villages. Exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Imagine a delicious patty nestled between two buns with cheese and ketchup. It's not a burger. That patty is actually sausage, which makes this a sandwich. A breakfast sausage sandwich. The new $1.99 sausage sandwich from McDonald's. Made with RSPCA assured pork. Until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary. Upcharges and fees apply to delivery. Subject to availability.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, some news just coming in to us at Times Towers, which we will pass straight on to you. Ghislaine Maxwell will remain in prison and her conviction on sex trafficking charges will stand, as the Supreme Court has announced it's not going to take up an appeal of her case. We'll have a little bit more for that in the bulletin at 3 and then in the next hour of our programme too. It's 9 minutes to 3 now, though. Jilly Cooper's death was announced this morning. She died after a fall. She was 88. Her canon of work spanned 6 decades. She started writing on the invitation of Harold Evans here at the Sunday Times, who gave her a regular column after being impressed by her sharp eye and honest thoughts about home life, original in an article called The Young Wife's Tale. Now, 6 novels about the raunchy love lives of young women called things like Octavia and Bella and Emily then led to real big-time stuff with the publication of Riders. Her hero, the rampant Rupert Campbell Black, was born, and the rest was publishing and then TV history. Loose men in tight jodhpurs with beautiful women scattered across the stable yard. It proved to be a winning formula. It might sound saccharine, but what saved Jilly's writing was that the women were inevitably cleverer than the men, and what was important was that they ended up happy. Now, Jilly came into Times Towers to talk to us a couple of years ago when her latest novel about the world of football, Tackle, was published. Here are her thoughts on King Charles and Queen Camilla, who were quite new in their job at the time.
I think, I mean, a hell of a job to follow. His mother was so sweet and gorgeous mother. I think he's doing fine, and Camilla's doing brilliantly too. I think he's doing fine. I just think it's a very, very difficult job to have to go abroad to all these places and say, oh, we want to be the court, we don't want to be part of England anymore. It's sad for him.
But how should he play it? Because you're right, it is quite a tricky one, that.
I think he's just got to go and be nice to everybody, and sort of, he's very good at plants. I know he does things in the country, and he's good at making the countryside better, isn't he?
Have you sent the Queen a copy of Tackle?
Mm.
Have you heard back?
No, not yet.
Well, she has got a few other things to do, but I'm pretty sure. I mean, I imagine she'll learn quite a lot from this book.
Well, I think she knows it all anyway.
Does she? Right. Well, she might well do.
Well, Queen Camilla was a big fan of Jilly, and it sounds as if Jilly was quite a big fan of Camilla. The Queen said, "Today may her hereafter be filled with impossibly handsome men and devoted dogs." Well, Pandora Sykes is a journalist, podcaster and writer who's done quite a bit of Jilly-related work, not least co-hosting the podcast that accompanied the TV adaptation of Rivals, and also narrating Between the Covers, the collection of Jilly's columns and writings. I asked her how she would describe Jilly's work to someone who hadn't ever come across her.
That's quite an entertaining question, because I was saying to my husband this morning, slightly weepily, you know, she really changed me as a teenager. And I know that's slightly strange to say about books that are largely about sex and posh people behaving badly. But when you describe her books, I think until you read them, you can't really explain how moving they are, because there is a lot. I mean, they were called bonkbusters for a reason. And there is a lot of posh people behaving really badly. But there is also this incredible sense of joy. And I'm so glad that I read books like that, that are sexy and joyful, when I was younger, because I think it really enriched my understanding of what being an adult could be like. You know, they're silly and funny, but it's also moving. Her world moved me.
I think it's such a good point to make, Pandora, and I would agree with you completely. It's somehow quite difficult to explain Jilly Cooper, isn't it? Because she's greater than the sum of her parts. And I think some of that as well is about the fact that she writes heroines that we want to invest ourselves into. Would that be a fair thing to say?
Yes, she writes wonderful heroines. And I think that was what one of the funnest things was about seeing Rivals on the screen, is seeing some of these really magical characters coming to life. And look, that's not to say that all of it would pass, you know, contemporary muster. But I think what's often missed about Jilly's writing is how she draws character and how she her world building. I think she's like Tolstoy or any of the greats that really evoke this entire world. She often got lumped into that sort of canon of like chick lit and sort of airport literature. And I'd actually argue that she's really not. And there's nothing wrong with those books, by the way, but I think she built something spectacular. She built a world, and the actual writing is sensational.
It does keep you in the book, doesn't it? Her writing and her pace. Do you think that she genuinely chose the more kind of broad brush commercial appeal, or it kind of chose her? Do you think she could have written a different type of book maybe halfway through her career when she had established herself?
It's a really good question. I think if you go back and read her nonfiction, her columns from when she was a newspaper columnist, which I only read because I was narrating the audiobook maybe 5 years ago. I think it was called Between the Covers. And she has got this very spry, funny way of writing. You know, she's a magpie. She's got that sort of Austen-like gimlet gaze. I don't know if I think she could have written differently. I'm sure she could have. I think she was unbelievably intelligent. I'm sure she could have. I just don't think she wanted to.
What do you think she really nailed about our class system? Because it lies at the heart of all of her books, doesn't it?
How completely ridiculous it is. How, from an outsider's point of view, as a lot of her characters are, it's almost impossible to understand. But what I love about her is actually even the rudest characters like Rupert Campbell Black, who becomes progressively nicer over the books because she fell in love with him and realised she had to redeem him. Even he cannot bear snobbery. So for all of the slightly hilarious and ridiculous class antics, she's really not a snob in her writing or as a person. I mean, anyone who knew Gilly knew she was never happier than with all of her dogs, and she had a badger walking stick. You know, she just loved animals.
And did you know her quite well?
No, I had the pleasure of doing a few work things with her, like narrating an audiobook, and I was lucky enough to host a podcast for Rivals when it came out last year, and we had a good chat then. But over the years, she has written me letters very sweetly. Whenever I've talked about her work or written about her work, she sent me a letter, and they're either wooden postcards or pop-up dogs or miniature letters. And my children always think they're for them because they do look like something that you would send a child. And I have had to hide them all from them, squirrel them away. And she gave me a beautiful brooch after I hosted the Rivals podcast, actually. I think it's a hound chasing a pheasant. I'm not very good on my country motifs, but either way, it's really lovely and I treasure it. She was an incredibly generous woman.
And was she a happy person? Quite often writers are people who write themselves happy. Do you know whether, you know, she kind of woke up in the morning and went, hello world, I love you, or woke up in the morning and went, hello world, I need to write that I love you?
Oh, I think she was the life and the soul of the party. I've actually just remembered that I wrote a prologue to Riders last year because it was its 40th edition. And I included in it a story that I didn't know she would necessarily want me to include, about how she was asked to stand down as the head of the RSPCA chapter or something like that in Gloucestershire, something animalish, because a picture of her had run in the newspaper in a see-through shirt snogging someone who wasn't her husband. And no, she loved that story. She was more than happy for it to be included. So I honestly think we can safely say she was a very joyful woman.
Have you ever been caught in a see-through shirt snogging someone who wasn't your husband? 0333 003 2353.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
3 o'clock on a sunny Monday afternoon, certainly in London. Hope it is with you. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover until 4 o'clock. In the next hour, the French Prime Minister has quit. Not for the first time. You might be thinking, I've heard this story before. Well, it's another one who's resigned today. Just how much of a lame duck is President Macron now? We'll talk about that. And Shadow Chancellor Mel Stride has been talking to the Tory conference in Manchester. Can there be a great Tory party revival? We'll talk to Kate Fall after the bulletin at 3 here on Times Radio, read by Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Dame Jilly Cooper has been described as an inspiration to a generation of women, writers and more. The best-selling author died yesterday at the age of 88 after a fall, which her children have said came as a complete shock. In a post on X, the publishing house Penguin Books wrote, "The world is a drabber, less gorgeous place without you." She's best known for her romance novels set in the fictional English county of Rutshire, including Mount and Rivals. Jane and Fee spoke to her back in November 2023. She told them about the time she'd lost an early manuscript.
Years ago, I wrote a book called Riders. But 10 years before, I took it out to lunch to do some corrections on the bus. And I got it back to Putney, and it had gone. So I lost the manuscript. Can you imagine the horror? But 10 years later, I finished it, and it was a much better book than it would have been. So I've been very, very touching, but I've been very lucky in life.
Labour is accusing the Conservatives of making big promises without saying how they'll pay for them. Shadow Chancellor Mel Stride told the Tory conference they'd scrap business rates for shops and pubs and offer a £5,000 national insurance rebate to first-time full-time workers. He said those plans are possible thanks to a £47 billion savings package, but opponents don't buy it. Dominic was listening to the speech but wanted a bolder vision.
I think 5 out of 10. There were some good things in there. The business rates were good. The first homes money was good, but again, it's tinkering around the edges. I think at the end of the day, £50 billion in government cuts is a rounding error.
Ghislaine Maxwell has been denied an appeal on her sex trafficking conviction by the US Supreme Court. The British former socialite was convicted in December 2021 on 5 counts of aiding Jeffrey Epstein in his abuse of underage girls. The Supreme Court receives around 8,000 petitions each year and hears only 200 of them. The US Justice Department had urged the court to reject her appeal after announcing the Epstein case was closed. Israel says it's deported 171 activists, including Greta Thunberg, from the Gaza-bound Global Summit flotilla to Greece and Slovakia. Overnight, the pro-Palestinian group announced the Swedish environmentalist would be moved on from where she was being held. She was among 450 campaigners who were detained by Israel when its military intercepted the flotilla last week. The mother of murdered teenager Dejon Campbell's called her son's killers pathetic cowards following their sentencing. The 15-year-old was stabbed to death with a machete in Woolwich in southeast London in September last year. Imre Due received 21 years in prison for murder, while Marco Ballas got 9 years for manslaughter. Dejon's mother, Jodian Taylor, calls for more action to prevent knife crime.
My biggest fear was to get that phone call that he was hurt, but instead, I'm living my worst nightmare, that he's no longer here. He didn't even get a second chance. And the bit that hurts is that it could have been prevented.
Following Storm Amy over the weekend, 8,500 homes in Scotland are still without power. The Highlands is the worst affected area, where some rail lines are also having to be repaired. The coast of Western Scotland saw gusts of almost 100 miles an hour on Friday. And for a roundup of news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Thank you for your messages so far this afternoon. Susanna texts in to say, as a teenager in the 70s and young adult in the 80s, Jilly Cooper made it okay to enjoy oneself and have a laugh whilst empathising with Imogen, Bella, Octavia and all. Sue's not happy though. Doesn't like the adoration of Jilly Cooper's writing. Well, I'll tell you what, Sue, she sold more than 11 million copies of her books. And I think not everybody read them to take them entirely seriously, but you could definitely guarantee that there wouldn't be too many jolts of sinister drama in them, and that happiness would ensue for most of the women in the books most of the time. I think what she did manage to do was write a pastiche of some quite ridiculous, pompous men. I wouldn't say that that's something to be entirely dismissive of.
I wouldn't dismiss any writer who can royally entertain on the scale that she could and did. And I said to you earlier, there's a book she wrote about the class system. I think it's just called Class.
Yeah.
And it's one of the funniest books I've ever read. It absolutely nails. I think she goes through, she's got a working class couple, a lower middle class, then an upper middle class, or are they just middle class, an upper class, and their various tendencies and habits and use of language. I think that book probably would still stand the test of time if you read it now. Clever woman. Very clever.
But Sue, I'm sorry if you're finding it a little bit too much that we are celebrating the life of Gilly Cooper today. But also, it is just sad on the day that somebody's died. It might not be the place for some of the more kind of dismissive elements of literary critique. The Conservatives are pledging to scrap business rates and give young people a £5,000 rebate on their national insurance payments. Shadow Chancellor Mel Stride told the annual party conference that the Tories were the only party standing up for fiscal responsibility.
Let's face it, we're the only party that gets it. The only party that will stand up for fiscal responsibility. And that means we have to face some hard truths to which other parties turn a blind eye. We must get on top of government spending. Where Labour have failed, we will bring down our spiralling welfare bill. Completely overhaul our benefit system.
Well, the Shadow Chancellor Mel Stride speaking there. Tory leader Kemi Badenoch also said that she'll pull the UK out of the European Convention on Human Rights as she tries to get her party back from being third in the polls. Plenty to talk about with Kate Fall, Conservative peer and former Deputy Chief of Staff to David Cameron. Very good afternoon, Kate Fall. Can I just ask you, if you were listening to Mel Stride's speech there and all of the things that he claims that the Conservatives are, definitely on the side of fiscal responsibility, the party who can get on top of government spending, is there a little bit of you that goes, oh, hang on a sec, what happened in the last decade?
Well, I think you make a very good point. I mean, look, the Tories still have a long way to go to own that fiscal prudence that they lost towards the end of their time in power with the Liz Truss budget. But having said that, I think it's exactly the right place for the Tories to be going, because it is the place where no one else is owning fiscal prudence, small state. We've got reform talking about actually quite large spending plans and getting rid of the two children cap. And you've got, of course, Labour spending quite a lot, putting up taxes. So here's an opportunity for the Tories. But they do, as you've just alluded to, have quite a long way to go to win back trust in the economy. Yeah. But it's so exactly where they should be heading.
Wouldn't it be better and wouldn't it be fantastic if you could see an opposition politician stand up and actually say, look, these are all of the things that we got wrong. We have learnt by our mistakes. We completely messed up the books. We had a disastrous budget under Kwasi Kwarteng. We know that we hurt your businesses. Mea culpa. But because of all of that, we are the party that's going to get it and do it better the next time. You can't hide all of that down the back of the sofa and expect somebody to sit down and have a comfortable ride.
Well, I would agree with that. I think, you know, there is a moment, a very powerful moment in politics when you do have to say we got these things wrong. We have a good track record in the past on the economy, but the recent past has not been good. And you're absolutely right. They need to own that, apologise and move on. I think, look, the opportunity remains that if they can win that back and they really are the one party that is talking about smaller state and fiscal prudence. And I would add to that this hugely increasing welfare bill. I think it's very important to have a national conversation about what we think is right on welfare, who we think we should be paying benefits for, helping people who need the help, but helping people back to work who can work, especially our young people. So I feel like there's a national conversation that the Tories should and should be having in this space, which would make a lot of sense.
If you were a young person and a political party wanted to woo you with saying that you'd get a £5,000 rebate on national insurance payments, would you go straight down the spoons and celebrate over that? I mean, you can see what the Conservative Party is trying to do there, but actually that's a slightly kind of convoluted prize to be offering, isn't it?
Well, look, I think it's good that they're is a policy there directed at young people? It's better than there not being anything for the young people at all. But again, a good point. You know, who are these policies for? I mean, they still have the triple lock on pensions. So there is a generational disparity there, which I do think that the Tories need to think about. And it does look like, look, we're keeping the votes there because they're the people who are voting for us now. But, you know, they've got to win back the support of the young. And on that same thought, whilst I understand that there's some frustrations about some of the climate policies, I do think green is an important policy for our country, but also for young people. So I don't think that the Tory party should entirely give up on their green agenda either.
And what about this promise to pull out of the European Convention of Human Rights? What do you think that will do in terms of swinging anybody's opinion or love for the Conservative Party back?
Well, I'm a little bit sceptical about this policy myself. I mean, look, there is the difficulty of illegal migration and solving that. It's extremely complicated. There are things we can be doing, like, you know, using getting through all those asylum backlogs. We're trying to do more with the boats. The deportation problem is an issue. But there are things you can do before you just say we're pulling out, because there are downsides to that. You know, the way in which our people, when they travel the world, are looked after. We talked about, you know, they haven't talked about policing in the EU and all sorts of other things. And we are, in the end, an internationalist party, or used to be. So I wouldn't go running to that. And I think there's a danger that the Tories become a sort of Farage light, rather than creating a party which is their own party, which is internationalist, which is, you know, fiscally prudent, which has creative ideas on innovation, on green policies, not just sort of picking off and reassuring and trying to be a bit too like the people that are winning their votes.
What do you make of the complete lack of, excuse my language, Kate Ford, but bums on seats at the party conference so far?
Well, look, I haven't been in Manchester this week, but I've obviously been watching it closely. I mean, there have been times in the past where I've been up to the conference. I remember the Ian Duncan Smith years, where there were few people around and it felt like, you know, a low point. So, you know, we're at a low point again. I really do hope, and I believe strongly, we've got years to go for the next election, that the party will be able to turn a corner. But you're absolutely right. You know, at this conference this week, we've heard suddenly they have something to say, quite a lot of policies, but is anyone listening? And is it really getting the coverage that, you know, we used to get? It's not even running on the 1 o'clock news headline. So I think a long way to go before the party is rebuilt.
Sure. Do you think it is therefore rather an inevitability that there does have to be a change at the top?
I don't think it's inevitability that the party is in long-term decline. I think it's got it's got time, and it's got great people and a future, as long as they keep on attracting new talent. And in terms of the top, look, Kemi seems to be having a decent week. You know, she went right in there and made that speech to give momentum and to frame the conference at the beginning. But, you know, the Tories will be very worried about the way the polls are, that they are very ruthless about their leaders. I don't think Kemi had as long as she thought she had. And I think if the May elections look really bad for her, that might well be an issue for her.
Yeah. I mean, I very much heard what you said about the Conservative Party needing to find positive and creative messages to send out. And if we take climate just as one of the incredibly important topics that all politicians need to be able to sell us their policies about, do you honestly think that the New Look Conservative Party will head in a kind of liberal direction on climate, when actually the most noise, the most attention, the most applause seems to be going to Donald Trump, who does anything but that?
I think that's right. And I think there's an issue about, you know, was net zero a good policy, and does that work? And who's paying for those green policies in terms of worrying about cost of living on families up and down the country, and then abandoning green altogether? And that's what I mean when I say about innovative policies. And don't forget, there are votes the Tories are losing in the centre ground to the Lib Dems. And that's why I'd like to see leadership which is aware of the many people in the country with their many concerns. Think about the sort of issues that resolve the big problems in Britain today, and climate is one of them. So I really don't want to see the party give up on green.
It doesn't show any sign that it's going to do anything but give up on green. I mean, you know, Kemi is a woman who wants to drill baby drill in the North Sea again. And I suppose I'm pushing you on this, Kate Fall, because for so many of our listeners, there is a frustration about not being able to see a clear vision for the Conservative Party in the future. And that is simply what's going to lead people to vote for reform.
Well, I think the path, in my own view, I think they're right to pursue a strong, prudent fiscal policy. Hopefully people will decide not to punish them for the mistakes they made at the end of the time with Liz Truss. A smaller state, tackling welfare, not least because it's a tragedy to have young people, you know, stuck on benefits. I would like to see some innovative Conservative answers on climate, whether that's harnessing business or harnessing innovation or tech or whatever it is, more policies on young people or for young people. So there's lots to be done, and they've got bright people there and they've got some talent in the pipeline. So, yeah, let's hope that now they've started making policies, they'll keep on going and get some good ones.
Who would you say is the brightest person there at the moment?
I think there are lots of bright people in the party, some of whom aren't actually MPs at the moment. I mean, I was always a big fan of someone called Rupert Harrison, who used to work for George Osborne, a brilliant economist. I hope that he'll make his way into Parliament. I'm a big fan of Laura Trott. I think she handles herself very well. She's done extremely well in that education portfolio. People talking quite a lot about Katie Lamb. You've got a good policy mind in Neil O'Brien. So you've got some good younger people coming through in the party. I hope we see a bit more of them.
Good to talk to you this afternoon. Thank you very much indeed. Kate Fall is a Conservative peer and former Deputy Chief of Staff to David Cameron. I suspect that is part of the problem, isn't it, Jane? Because Kate Fall has given us a list of names there, and I think I can picture Laura Trott. The others I can't.
Rupert Harrison. I know the name. Is he BlackRock? Is he the investment person? Yes. Felix, our producer, is nodding. So I think Rupert's got a few quid. Might be worth a go. They need to do something, don't they? Coming next, let's trot out the line. It's deja vu all over again as another French Prime Minister resigns. We will have the very latest news on that for you at Times Radio. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Party conference season is here, and Times Radio is your backstage pass to the biggest political events of the year. The Conservative Party Conference is underway in Manchester. Hear live coverage and incisive reaction with regular reports from Times Radio's political editor, Anna Mihailova, throughout the conference, plus Kemi Badenoch's speech in full on Wednesday. Continues this afternoon from 4 with John Pienaar, live from the Conservative Party Conference in Manchester on Times Radio.
Life's like a photo album. Mine bring back so many memories. That's a street party on VE Day. Me, 3 years old. Oh, here's me, 17, teddy boy. Our wedding. Didn't my Shirley look lovely? Holiday in Devon when the boys were small. They tower over me now. Oh, now these are the more recent ones on my phone. Oh, that's me and Kate enjoying a game of cards. She's my care professional from home instead. Kind, funny and very good at gin rummy. Since Shirley passed away, Kate comes to the house most days to help with the things I can't manage so well now. She's great company. I mean, the boys visit me most weekends, but they can't be here all the time. So home instead have really helped. I have the best quality care, but in my own home, from Kate. She's wonderful. Though she will have to let me win at cards now and again.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Amazon Prime Big Deal Days are the 7th and 8th of October. 2 days of big deals on electronics, home, kitchen and more. That'll make you feel less like and more like feel like a big deal. Amazon Prime Big Deal Days are the 7th and 8th of October, exclusively for Prime members. Join Prime now.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
21 minutes past three. Now, Liz Truss did 49 days as British Prime Minister, and the woman is still much mocked. But maybe we should turn our attention to a Frenchman. The Prime Minister, Sébastien Lecornu, quit his role as French PM today. He'd done 26 days. Catherine Norris-Trent is senior correspondent for France 24. Catherine, tell us why he had to go.
Hello there. Yeah, it's all been a bit of a shock, really, in France today because it was so quick. He went basically because he wasn't able to put together a government, a cabinet. The different warring parties in France simply couldn't agree, and he'd been trying to sort it out for 26 days. He'd announced a government. He thought he'd come up with a team, and then instantly one of them started criticising that on Twitter, the man named as Interior Minister. And so basically collapsed in a big row, and he called their bluff this morning by basically saying, this is ungovernable, you're not compromising, so I'm going to walk.
He made some accusations about egos at play, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. He said that the parties were all acting as if they had majorities in Parliament, which, of course, no party or block of party in France's Parliament has an overall majority. And so he said, you know, they were acting as if they had the power. They were acting, you know, out of ego, but that it wasn't realistic. And, you know, he was due to hold his first cabinet meeting this afternoon. Tomorrow, he was supposed to be going to Parliament for the first time as Prime Minister and making a big speech about the future direction of his government. But instead, we've got a deepening of the political crisis in France.
Most people in Britain have only a very, and I'm certainly talking about myself here, a vague understanding of how France works. The real power is with the presidency. That's right, isn't it? Because people must look at this and think, well, why isn't Macron at risk? Could he resign? Is there any way that could happen?
Actually, there's mounting pressure on Emmanuel Macron to resign. Now, he doesn't have to. Constitutionally, he's been elected in separate presidential elections to serve a 5-year term, and that runs until 2027. And people close to the president have been saying, no matter what, he's not going to resign. But every time a government, a prime minister, has to resign because they can't agree on anything, can't get a budget passed, well, there are more and more calls, especially from Marine Le Pen's party, for him to resign. And in fact, opinion polls show that about 2/3 of the French public would like Macron to go. At the moment, that's not on the cards because in France, there's a president and then there's also a parliament with a prime minister and government. And this is about the prime minister and government in parliament resigning rather than Emmanuel Macron. But he is in political hot water. There's no doubt about it.
Well, what does he do now then? Just appoint another prime minister?
Well, this is the question. Does he call fresh snap elections? We had those in June and July of last year, of 2024, and that's when we came with this deadlock parliament. That was the result out of it. Or does he resign? Or does he name another prime minister? So we're trying to work out at the moment what he's likely to do. In fact, I think Emmanuel Macron is trying to work out what he's likely to do. He was pictured this morning in the streets of Paris, walking around the Île de la Cité near Notre Dame, by himself with a couple of security guards behind him on the phone. And it looks like he's floundering. There was talk that perhaps he could go on one of the big news shows here in Paris tonight. At this stage, it's not said that he's doing it. So he's probably still weighing up a decision as far as we're aware.
So is it completely out of the question that perhaps he does do a big address to the nation and says, you know what, you can have your wish, I'm going. What happens then?
Well, that would be completely uncharted waters. France, under its current constitution, the Fifth Republic, has never had such a scenario, and it wasn't foreseen in the drawing up of the constitution. So if that happened, it would be a political earthquake. If he did that, perhaps he would have to leave a few months to try for the parties to get ready for new parliamentary and presidential elections, to try and get their affairs in order and to have an election campaign. But again, that's very And that's speculation. We don't know that he's going to do that. But yeah, it would be completely uncharted territory for him to do that. And again, it is possible, but whether he'll cede to the pressure, whether he'll give it another go, is everyone's guess.
Now, there are all sorts of melodramatic headlines I've been looking at over the last couple of hours. One says, France is now the sick man of Europe. And in some ways, you get the impression that the rest of Europe is rather enjoying this, which isn't fair, because France is a beautiful and wonderful country. But the economy, to put it mildly, has challenges, doesn't it?
It has huge challenges. They've got massive public debt, and the EU has been warning them for a couple of years now to really try and get that under control and to bring it within the 3%. The deficit has to be within 3% of the GDP, according to EU rules. And France is basically at nearly 6%. And so the whole problem is they're trying to pass this budget, or the latest prime minister was trying to pass a budget with more than 40 billion euros of spending cuts, basically austerity, and no parliament will pass that through. So now the economy is frozen. This budget from this year looks likely to be run over into next year, when, you know, the eurozone are really worried about one of its biggest economies going into freefall. We've had France's credit rating coming down, and the French stock exchange, the CAC 40, fell this morning after the surprise news that the prime minister was resigning. So yeah, it's not good news for the economy at a time when France needs good news on that front rather than more turmoil.
And what about the chances of protest, Catherine?
Oh, well, they're very high. I mean, that's a given. We've been having weekly protests ever since la rentrée, when France got back to work and back to school after the summer holidays. You know, we do love a good protest here in France, and that's very much part of the social fabric. And there's a real feeling, though, of disenchantment with politicians among the public, a real feeling that things haven't been working properly for years. So I think it's, you know, at this time of political negotiations with the parties trying to play for power, even though there's no government, they'll still be trying to position themselves. They will definitely be protests coming up in this time. And just, you know, how big those will be, that could put pressure on whoever's trying to form the next government.
And the party of Marine Le Pen, even if let's say she did win the presidential election, if not her, the young man, I'm afraid I can't remember his name.
Jean-Van Bardella.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thank you very much, Catherine. France would still have those problems. I mean, they still have but compared to us, they have a relatively early retirement age, don't they? The economy would still be a huge challenge.
Absolutely. Those problems are not going anywhere. And in fact, the party of Marine Le Pen and Jordan Bardella say they want to bring down the retirement age, which is at 62. They want to bring it back down to 60. So it's unclear how that would help France's economy. In fact, you know, economists have warned against saying that they need to put the retirement age up, but that's not a popular policy. And the Rassemblement National, Le Pen's party, is a populist policy. So they're kind of trying to appeal to people, saying that they will make working conditions and living costs, then they'll help ordinary French people with those things. In reality, they would have very little margin for manoeuvre. We should note, though, however, at the moment, Marine Le Pen is actually barred from running for office. Remember that court case when she got found guilty of embezzlement of EU funds? Now, she is appealing that, but that's not set to take place until next summer. So if there were possibly presidential elections held within the coming months, she actually might not be eligible for it.
So timing not quite right for her. You briefly mentioned that the stock market in France had gone down. Have things stabilised slightly, Catherine?
Yeah, they've stabilised since the initial fallings. But I think people are wondering what's going to happen in the coming hours and days, because this is chronic instability now. I feel like I've been talking about France's political crisis for the past 2 years, maybe, and we've had it really deepening and in this kind of death spiral almost for a year and a half now. So clearly, businesses looking to invest in France are put off by that. Financial institutions such as the EU and the IMF have been worried about France's performance. And yeah, it will come down to the market. So we're looking to see whether they rally by the end of the day and whether instability continues into a pattern of a few days.
Really interesting to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. That's Catherine Norris-Trent, Senior Correspondent for France 24.
The retirement age being set at 60. The stuff of dreams.
Well, it's not, I mean, yes, you can imagine why people would vote for it, but it's not realistic, is it?
Not really.
No.
Not when longevity is on the horizon.
We'd all love it if we could retire. What was it? The Greeks used to retire at 55 and just eat olives and while away the decades. But it doesn't. In the end, you've got to pay the price.
You do. Coming up, we'll be speaking to Taylor Swift's former manager on whether she was always destined for world domination. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Queen has said she hopes Gilly Cooper's hereafter be filled with impossibly handsome men and devoted dogs. The best-selling author died unexpectedly yesterday after a fall. She was 88. Her work spans six decades and her book sold over 11 million copies in the UK alone. Speaking to Times Radio last year, she was very modest about her career.
Oh, I've been very, very touching, but I've been very lucky in life. I work quite hard.
Journalist Pandora Sykes co-hosted the podcast that accompanied the TV adaptation of Rivals and narrated Between the Covers, a collection of Gilly's columns and writings. She described the impact of her work.
She really changed me as a teenager. And when you describe her books, I think until you read them, you can't really explain how moving they are, because there is a lot. I mean, they were called bonkbusters for a reason. And there is a lot of posh people behaving really badly. But there is also this incredible sense of joy. And I'm so glad that I read books like that, that are sexy and joyful, when I was younger.
The Conservatives say they would scrap business rates for shops and pubs if they're in government. Labour's accused the Tories of making big promises without sharing how they'd be paid for. Two teenagers described as cowardly have been jailed for a total of more than 30 years for killing a 15-year-old boy in a machete attack in southeast London. Dejan Campbell was ambushed in Woolwich in September last year. The US Supreme Court's denied Ghislaine Maxwell's request to appeal her sex trafficking conviction. The former girlfriend of Jeffrey Epstein was sentenced in June 2022 to 20 years in prison for her role in luring teenage girls to be abused. And former England rugby union captain Lewis Moody says he's focused on staying positive after being diagnosed with motor neurone disease. It's the same illness that's claimed the lives of Doddy Weir and Rob Burrow. For a news roundup of news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
The Monopoly game at McDonald's is back. There's over £2 million worth of cash prizes to be won. And a chance to get your hands on some epic prizes. Go on, it's your go. 18 plus, UK, ends 21st of October. Selected menu items. App may be required. May depend on winning moment. See mcdrules.co.uk.
Amazon Prime Big Deal Days are the 7th and 8th of October. 2 days of big deals on electronics, home, kitchen and more. That'll make you feel less like... and more like... feel like a big deal. Amazon Prime Big Deal Days are the 7th and 8th of October. Exclusively for Prime members. Join Prime now.
Stayshore. What is Stayshore? Stayshore is not just the UK's favourite travel insurance. Stayshore is the confidence that comes with knowing that you're covered by the company with more five-star reviews on Trustpilot than any other provider. A company that welcomes people of all ages with pre-existing medical conditions for single or multiple trips. So Stayshore with Stayshore Travel Insurance. UK's favourite relates to number of five-star Trustpilot reviews, T's and C's and verifications at stayshore.co.uk/reviews.
Imagine a delicious patty nestled between two buns with cheese and ketchup. It's not a burger. That patty is actually sausage, which makes this a sandwich. A breakfast sausage sandwich. The new £1.99 sausage sandwich from McDonald's. Made with RSPCA assured pork. Until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary. Upcharges and fees apply to delivery. Subject to availability.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wickes, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wickes.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wickes store.
Yes, do that.
Taylor Swift has released her 12th studio album, The Life of a Showgirl, dropped on Friday to, I think we have to say, rather mixed reviews. I've been talking to somebody who was there at the start of it all. Rick Barker was her first manager. He's also contributed to a new Channel 4 documentary, which is simply called Taylor, exploring the legacy of the global pop star. Well, of course, lots of young stars look like they have something special. It is that weirdly intoxicating thing of young people having talent. But now, with the benefit of hindsight, I asked Rick what it was that Taylor had as a young teen.
You always think that your artist has something, but she had something. And what she had wasn't the most amazing singing voice. What she had wasn't years of experience touring, but what she did have was the ability to make people feel seen. And that's a superpower. And that's something where most of the time the artists are on stage, they're the ones being seen. Taylor made the fan feel like they were seen as well. And just seeing the way she interacts with people, seeing the way that she treated it like a business, that's what made her special. And that's what made her different, is she's like, okay, here's the goal. If I want to sell, because she had asked me, I want a gold record. I said, awesome, let's go meet 500,000 people and sell 500,000 records. She took it upon herself, said, I'm going to use all the tools necessary, whether it be MySpace, radio, in person, where most artists wait for the people to find them. She went out and found the people.
You also say in the documentary, which is really interesting, about her kind of desire to make people feel better after she'd met them than they had done before. Now, that's something different to actually just wanting to maximize your own earning potential, reach to fans, or whatever it is. And something like that can be incredibly draining.
Oh, yes.
So why do you think she wanted to do that for people?
I think she was desiring someone to pay attention to her when she was a teenager and wasn't getting that. You know, she was getting picked on. She was getting bullied. She was different. She wanted to write songs. All her other friends wanted to go to prom and football games and things like that. So she was always considered the outsider. But what she did was she found those other people that also felt like they were the outsider. And she, for whatever reason, she wanted to spend time with them. And when many artists after a show would disappear and go on the bus, we would go out and she would sign autographs and take pictures and meet people for 3 hours, 4 hours. Then we'd get on a bus and go to the next town and do it all over again. And people in Nashville were looking, going, why is she doing this? And I don't think she ever said, I'm going to do it because I'm going to be the richest artist in the world. I think she did it because that's what it felt like she needed to do. She genuinely wanted to thank them for staying and meeting her. And money became the byproduct. Mm. Becoming a billionaire became a byproduct. Having the biggest tour in the world became a byproduct of that early on building of relationships.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Her ability to appear as a very relatable character in people's lives. And I completely hear you about her having a tough time at middle school in particular, wasn't it? But actually, she has lived her entire adult life as a very unrelatable person. You know, she did achieve her stardom. She had the money. As you say, you were on tour, you know, at the age of 17. So how she managed to pull that off? Does it all come from that early well?
I don't know. I just think some people are built for it and some people aren't. That's why not everyone is the best footballer in the world or the best of anything. She has always had superstar potential. And I think with that came superstar responsibilities. And if you look at it and you think of it from a talent aspect, what's the difference between a star and a superstar? It's usually the business side. It's not the talent side. It's not anything other than understanding who their audience is, staying true to who their audience is, and making sure that their audience feels seen. And I think she makes her audience feel seen better than anyone.
Very few super successful in their early years, young people, seem to manage to keep their balance in adult life. How do you think she's done it? Why has she been able to do it when, I mean, let's face it, you know, people like Britney have not managed it. You know, we could name a whole host of other Hollywood stars as well who haven't managed it. What's kept her okay?
I think it's her parents. I think they've kept her grounded. I think that they knew from an early age that they wanted to be the ones guiding her. They have always played a very active role, whether people in the industry like that or don't like that. I think it's super important because no one...
Did you like it, or was it difficult to deal with?
I enjoyed it. I did. I learned a ton from both of them, actually all three of them. So I didn't mind it at all. But a lot of people can't handle that. A lot of people don't want the parents involved. As a parent of a 23 and a 21-year-old, no one cares more about my kids than me. I don't care if it's a coach. I don't care if it's a teacher. I don't care who it is. So there's not a lot of parents that know how to balance it. I think her parents balanced it very well, sacrificed a ton.
Does she leave people behind, and did she leave you behind?
No, I actually, it was a mutual decision for us to leave. I can't speak on whether she leaves people behind. I can only speak on my behalf. But my last year with her in 2007, I would drive from Santa Barbara, California to Los Angeles, catch an airplane, land in Nashville, catch a bus, tour for 4 days, come back. I weighed almost 300 pounds. I was having some health issues we couldn't identify, and I had a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old that I was gone 187 days from. I missed birthdays, I missed anniversaries, and I'm like, all right, God, what's the plan? I'm going to make more money than I've ever seen in my life, but at what expense? My life, being a father to my kids. So I chose the family, and I sat down, we had lunch, and I said, listen, I'll forever be grateful, and I will always be a fan, I said, but the kids and my family mean everything to me.
When Taylor goes forward with her life, she's going to get married. Congratulations to her. You know, I wish her every success, actually. But there's definitely something that happens to women in the public eye when they get older. Their appearance is focused on, over-focused on for a start. And sometimes there's a real cattiness about motherhood and how women manage to balance motherhood and their own stardom. What do you think will happen to her now? How do you think people will treat Taylor going forward?
Depends on the people. The Swifties will love her forever, no matter what. The people who truly believe in her are happy for her. I'm excited for her to be a mom. I'm excited for her to be
able... If she chooses to be Rick as well, and we should pop that in there,
and
shouldn't
we? That's the thing. I'm excited for her to be a mom if she chooses to, because I saw the way she was with my kids. I saw the way she was with young people in the lines when they would come up and meet her, and she was very approachable. And I hope she gets that opportunity if she chooses to do so. As far as looks and everything like that, I mean, I don't know. Why are women so hard on other women? It's usually not the guys that do it, it's the women.
Oh, no, sometimes it is the guys.
Yeah, well, the guys are just guys, you know. We have an excuse. We're guys.
But, oh, my God.
But why is it that the women get after the women? That's what I get curious about.
Well, that is a whole show that we could do, and I would so love to do that, and you are definitely a guest on it. But we've probably got to leave it there. Just some thoughts, actually, about her latest album. Just from the visuals of it, from what we know of it, it definitely seems to be Taylor going a little bit different. What do you think?
I like it. I love her evolution. I love the fact that she's able, once again, she knows her audience better than anyone. And because she just doesn't randomly show up out of the blue and go, oh, hi, here's a new album. The buildup, I mean, they're genius. The buildup is genius.
Do you speak to her at all anymore?
I don't. We kind of went our different ways. It's like, how many of your former employees do you keep in contact with over the last 20 years that, you know, it's not that. I think if we were to see each other today, if we were to walk into a room, I can almost guarantee you that we would catch eyes and she would come and we would hug and she would immediately ask, how's Brianna and Logan and how's Jill? That's just the type of person that she is.
That is Rick Barker, and you can see the Taylor Swift documentary on Channel 4, simply called Taylor.
Well, that's a really good name for it.
It is, isn't
nothing
it?
Clever about it, nothing fancy.
They had a very long meeting, Jane.
They probably did. Right, now, every week on Off Air, our podcast, yes, we have a podcast, you'll be able to hear our brilliant interviews that we have on the Times Radio show. The podcast is called Off Air with Jane and Fee, and it comes your way Monday to Thursday at about 4 o'clock. Over the last couple of weeks, who have we had? Tim Spector, a lot of interest in what Tim Spector had to say about the gut.
Yes, he was talking about fermenting your gut.
That's right, he was. And kefir.
And lots of people weighed in with their own thoughts on the matter. The absolutely brilliant BBC journalist Lise Doucette was on talking about her book about Kabul and that wonderful hotel in the Afghan capital that has stood standing, still standing, through years of turmoil in Afghanistan. She was amazing. That was last week. It was last week, wasn't it, Lise Doucette? Yeah.
Yes.
And Ian McEwan, the novelist as well, appeared on Off Air. So make sure you don't miss it. We're also discussing all sorts of things, courtesy of your emails. And today's edition, if I say so myself, was a particularly highfalutin one involving putting off getting the boiler serviced, slightly over-the-top obituaries in the Liverpool Echo, and the merits of the dress code or lack of it at the Royal Opera House. Last week, we talked to the novelist Ken Follett. Now, Ken has long been a supporter of the Labour Party, and his wife, Barbara, was a Labour MP for Stevenage. He told us that both he and Barbara think the tide might just be turning for Keir Starmer.
What we have noticed over the last week or two is suddenly positive stories about Keir are appearing in the newspapers. And we're not privy to what's happening in number 10 Downing Street, but our guess is that somebody there has taken hold of their PR. I think Keir is great in many ways. One of the ways he's not great is PR. And I think there's signs now that he's figured out, or somebody has explained to him, that it's one thing to have the right policies, and it's a completely different thing to present them in such a way that the people can see that they're right. Mm. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people would say, this is not just my idea, a lot of people would say that that's been lacking a bit in the first year of government, and that it seems to be coming back now.
Ken Follett, with his take on what might be going on in Sir Keir Starmer's comms department.
There was also part of that interview where we talked about having an orgy with a point. But, you know, you take your pick.
Yes,
you want the politics or you want the Stone Age orgy.
Would I have chosen that particular extract from the interview? I'm not sure. Not considering what else we talked about. And we should say, we talked about the orgy. You'll be wondering what on it. Because it features in Ken Follett's new book, Circle of Days, which is, of course, about Stonehenge. Right, the point of all this was to alert you to Off Air with Jane and Fee, our hit podcast, available now.
I think we've got to get the branding right, haven't we? To be honest, people aren't listening for whether or not Keir Starmer's getting good PR. They're listening because they want to hear Ken Follett talk about Stone Age sex.
Right. Coming next on Times Radio, and this will cheer you up, are we about to experience a stock market crash? Don't go anywhere. It's 13 minutes to 4. Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Amazon Prime Big Deal Days are the 7th and 8th of October. 2 days of big deals on electronics, home, kitchen and more. That'll make you feel less like and more like feel like a big deal. Amazon Prime Big Deal Days are the 7th and 8th of October. Exclusively for Prime members. Join Prime now.
Imagine a delicious patty nestled between two buns with cheese and ketchup. It's not a burger. That patty is actually sausage, which makes this a sandwich. A breakfast sausage sandwich. The new $1.99 sausage sandwich from McDonald's. Made with RSPCA assured pork. Until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary. Upcharges and fees apply to delivery. Subject to availability.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
on Times Radio.
Whether anyone will now listen to Off Air with Jane and Fee on the strength of our promotional attempt just before the ad break, I don't know. What do you think, Fee?
I think they will give it a little bit of a whirl just to see whether or not we're quite as stupid, ignorant, daft.
No, I think the phrase,
sexually oriented.
You're groping for the phrase wide ranging. And that is what,
as we've made ourselves sound.
That is what Off Air. Yeah,
you go find out.
Gifts you. Exactly. There's a challenge. It's Off Air with Jane and Fee. You will find it occasionally in the podcast charts. We can't believe it either. Now, despite lots of concerns about the economy, gold prices have rocketed up 50% in the past year. The stock market has done well, and Bitcoin, although volatiles, have almost doubled in price in the last 12 months. Concerns are now being raised. There is a bubble that could soon burst. Adam Shaw is our money man. I'm concerned that my volatiles have doubled in price in the last 12 months. What's going on?
I mean, lots of asset prices have risen very significantly. And that's a bit odd, in a way, because I'm sure, as you talk about on this programme, the world is not shiny and bright, filled with optimism. There's lots of concerns about the economy. I mean, in a way, it started happening, I think, even when Trump announced all of those tariffs. The stock market plummeted and then rocketed up, I think 60% up since that fall.
Yeah.
And it's a good question. Why? I think there might be quite a lot of psychology around this. In a sense, people become inured to it. They go, just another sort of mad thing happening to the market. How much can we respond to this? And there's also a thing, which I've seen in lots of times in the past, and myself, I've looked at assets and gone, there's no reason for this to be up. Actually, this should be down. Now, who's the idiot? The person who doesn't invest because logically it's not worth that, or the person who goes, I don't care if it's really worth that, I'll buy it today because it'll be worth tomorrow. It will be worth more tomorrow. And I think there's a bit of sense of that happening, certainly with gold, sort of FOMO, fear of missing out. People are buying into gold, partly because they're not sure what else to do, but just they see the price rise, well, I'll buy into it. So I think there's a lot of that going on.
Yeah, because you think, well, I can't miss out.
You can't miss out.
But how does the average Joanna buy gold?
Well, buying gold is problematic, to be honest, because even if you buy it, I mean, I think you go to the Royal Mint. I have to say I've never bought gold myself, but there are a couple of ways of doing this. You can buy gold bars, which are hard to store, don't pay interest. What on earth are you going to do with the thing? One more portable way of doing that is going to a reputable coin dealership and you buy old sovereigns. So that's their coins. You can put them in your pocket. But the big way people have bought this is something through called ETFs, exchange traded funds, basically like shares. Mm-hmm. And therefore you're buying into a company which owns gold.
Okay.
And that's really easy to do. And therefore you never having actually to manage a block of gold in the house, which is extremely dangerous, I would have thought.
But in order to benefit from this, you have to get rid of your gold at the right time. And who's going to tell you when to do that?
Well, no one will tell you when to do that. And if they do, they probably don't know what they're talking about. Calling the top of the market is notoriously difficult. Really easy to say there's an asset price bubble after it's collapsed rather than just beforehand. And generally, what you find, I think JP Morgan did a lot of academic research into this, going, it's almost impossible to go in and out of the market and make money. Actually, over the long term, you just stick with it and try and sell it at the end. But it's problematic.
Ultimately, you're relying on somebody just needing to have something made out of gold, aren't you?
No.
Because this isn't just a currency.
Yeah, no, I disagree. I don't think that's true. Gold has become the sort of go-to asset in times of trouble. It's far beyond, actually, its actual use. You're not buying gold because you think it might turn into semiconductors.
But then doesn't that eventually burst?
Well, that is what I think me and many others are raising concerns, not predicting the bubble will burst, but going, there's lots of characteristics of this rise which make it susceptible to bursting. And if you're investing, you should be aware that those risks appear to be somewhat higher than normal.
Okay. So I started by saying that there were fears in some quarters, certainly not everywhere, that a stock market collapse could occur at some point in the next couple of, well, do the people who are doomsters think it might happen in weeks or in months? What?
October is a bad month. So we had crashes in October 1929, the big crash, October 1987 with the Black Monday, October 2008. October is an auspicious time. It's also interesting. I mean, you were talking about authors just beforehand. It's often a theme in literature, October being a dangerous month. Ray Bradbury talks about it being an evil month? Bad things happen in October, he says, in Something Wicked This Way Comes, and that's a recurring theme. And I think you shouldn't dismiss the psychology of all of this. It's summer is over, winter hasn't quite begun, the trees are shedding their leaves. There's a sense of change in the air, and it's not great change. And I think there's a reset, and that is something to be said about this, that actually people are a bit worried about what happens next. And so often it does happen in October, and that's why I think be aware.
Okay. Many people will know that AI stocks have shot up. Other people believe that they've shot up far too high, mm-hmm. and that can't be maintained, won't be maintained.
It's a bit like the dot-com bubble, wasn't it? I remember at the time, no one ever seemed to worry about whether any of these companies made a profit or not. You just invested in them. And we're seeing certain things like Nvidia invested $100 billion in its main customer, I think OpenAI. $100 billion is, I think, the GDP of Poland. One investment, right? So this is an enormous...
This makes my head spin. They're investing in each other.
Well, that's the good... You raise your eyebrows quite correctly. There are those who say this is a circular problem. I'm investing in my main customer, so my main customer can buy stuff from me. That is an...
With
odd,
money that which we...
Yes. Your quizzical look is well placed. And I think many are worried by that. Now, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but you go, that's another sign of actually a very sort of internal looking market that raises eyebrows. And you go, well, OK, as a one off, is that now becoming a theme? Are we all just investing each other in this sort of circular argument? And then it doesn't take much to break that. And we've got so many worries around in the world that you go, if anyone loses confidence in this, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm.
Have you seen Stuart's quote that he sent in?
Well, it's a wonderful quote. As Maynard Keynes said, markets can stay irrational for longer than you can stay solvent.
Irrational. They can stay irrational for long. That's right. So, which is my point beforehand, is that you can be right, but you'll lose money by being right because the market's just irrational and it keeps going and you can lose money. And that's, in fact, the theme of the film, The Big Short, which is a really good explanation of this, where the guy goes, the housing market doesn't make any sense. It must collapse. And the theme of that film is it doesn't collapse for ages. And he goes, this is fraudulent. It's madness. And in the end, he makes billions of pounds. But he might not have. He might have gone bust, despite being completely accurate.
Those of us who are simply concerned, let's just be honest, about our pensions.
Yeah.
As it happens, I think didn't we both just check our pensions over the last couple
of days? We did,
yeah. By pure fluke, I happened to have it. And of course, it's gone up. So I think, great, how wonderful.
Yes.
What do you do if it does suddenly plummet and then you start to panic?
Pensions are long-term investments. So really, this is a very specific thing to the individual. It depends how old you are and how close you are to retirement. If you're not very close to retirement, I'd worry much about it less. If you're very close to retirement, I would speak to your advisor. But your advisor, when you're near retirement, usually actually is taking you out of risky investments for exactly this reason. You don't want to be retiring next year. And if you're 100% in shares and the shares collapse, your whole life savings get wiped out, which is what generally happens is as you near that retirement, they start taking it out of the more risky investments and putting it into safer, more stable investments.
And that was one of the very cruel things about the Liz Truss quasi-Kwarteng budget and the subsequent fall, wasn't it? Because actually a lot of people who were very close to retirement found that bonds and gilts and the things that should have been incredibly safe.
Absolutely. So what is safe? This is the problem.
Yeah.
And also, specifically now, people are worried about what will happen in November in the budget, whether the Chancellor will get rid of or at least significantly reduce the cash-free lump sum they're getting. And a lot of people are cashing in now. Now, they may be right, they may be wrong. That's a big call because you can't put it back in. So that that lack of knowledge about what's happening is itself causing massive problems for people.
Yeah, budget not until November the 25th.
I know.
That's, or 26th, is
oh,
it?
Oh, don't ask me the actual. 26th,
yeah, forgive me,
yeah.
But that's a long, long time.
Yes, I'm sorry, I can see you getting bored with
no,
that already.
No, I'm not bored of it. I'm just worried that exactly as you said, yes. The speculation yeah. will just go on.
I'll tell you what, it's like the fourth horse of the apocalypse came into the studio 15 minutes ago,
sorry
isn't it?
Sorry about that. You were talking about Stonehenge orgies, and I really brought the mood down.
Did a bit. Oh, come back, Ken. Thank you very much, Adam. And if you want to know more about that, you can find more from Adam at themoneydoctor.tv or on his socials at Adam Shaw Biz, B-I-Z.
Up next, live from the Conservative Party conference, John Pienaar.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive Live from the Conservative Party conference in Manchester. And here are the headlines. Reform, UK-led Kent County Council is set to raise council tax despite promising savings. And Israel, Hamas and the US are holding indirect talks in an effort to confirm a deal to release the hostages and end the war in Gaza. And coming up, we're going to be watching those negotiations in Egypt. Can a deal be struck? I'm going to be talking to a US analyst and to a retired army general who's now the chief executive of the Halo Trust. And everything you want to know here from the Tory Party conference in Manchester. I'll be talking to a shadow minister, to former cabinet ministers, to a former mayor, and try and get the lowdown on how the party is trying to fight back against those dire, dire opinion polls.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. A rise of 5% in council tax could be on the cards for Reform UK's most prominent authority, despite the promise of savings. Kent County Council has been described as a testbed for the party's national policies. Times Radio's Emma Smith has more.
Nigel Farage had pledged cost-cutting when Reform took control of the council, as he described the scale of spending as beyond belief. But officials now admit services are already down to bare bones and a rise by the maximum rate of 5% may be needed. Before Reform's Doge team had had a chance to carry out detailed work in Kent, the authority has set up its own Department of Local Government Efficiency, so far identifying £40 million in savings over 4 years.
Delegates from the US, Israel and Hamas have begun indirect talks aimed at implementing a peace deal insisted on by Donald Trump. International peace negotiator Noumi Bar-Yakov is confident an agreement on the exchange of hostages can be agreed. She was also asked on Times Radio if Hamas are taking these talks seriously.
Yes, they're taking it seriously. The pressure is on from Donald Trump, both on Hamas and on Israel, to accept the terms of the deal and to get it executed as soon as possible.
Donald Trump has threatened Hamas with complete obliteration if it attempts to retain power in post-war Gaza. The best-selling author Dame Jilly Cooper has been described as a legend, who was a wonderfully witty and compassionate friend. The Queen has led tributes along with the Prime Minister, saying she wrote with wit, warmth and wisdom to shape British culture. Her novels, including Rivals, Riders and Polo, dissected the lives and escapades of upper-class social circles. Journalist Pandora Sykes co-hosted the podcast that accompanied the TV adaptation of Rivals. She says the way she wrote about the British class system was priceless.
What I love about her is actually even the rudest characters like Rupert Campbell Black, who becomes progressively nicer over the books because she fell in love with him and realised she had to redeem him. Even he cannot bear snobbery. So for all of the slightly hilarious and ridiculous class antics, she's really not a snob in her writing or as a person.
The Shadow Chancellor, Mel Stride, has pledged that the Tories would scrap business rates on leisure and hospitality sector if they win the next election. The large audiences at the Labour Party conference haven't been seen in Manchester as the party struggles to remain relevant with Reform beating them in the polls. Shadow Business Minister Harriet Baldwin recognises there's a lot of work to do with the public since the election results last year.
They are not yet ready. I think this is clear. To say we got rid of you last year, you're immediately the solution to our problems today. So we need to do the hard yards and the groundwork over these next 3 years. And I'm really, really encouraged by what we're hearing in Manchester. And I've been speaking to a wide range of different businesses here who have all said that they really are being held back by the current government.
Ghislaine Maxwell has been denied an appeal on her sex trafficking conviction by the US Supreme Court. The British former socialite was convicted in December 2021 on 5 counts of aiding Jeffrey Epstein in his abuse of underage girls. The US Justice Department had urged the court to reject her appeal after announcing the Epstein case was closed. And for a roundup of news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB. Online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with Barclays Corporate Banking.
It is good to have your company here on Drive on Times Radio. I'm John Pienaar, coming to you live from the Tory Party conference in Manchester. Now, everyone is still wondering whether this conference will turn out to be a bit of a damp squib, which is odd, because something momentous is happening here. Well, sort of momentous. I don't mean the torrent of policies coming out of the Tory shadow cabinet members, making up for precious time lost in their leader's step-by-step approach to political opposition. And I'm going to get you up to date with the latest ones. I don't even mean the fact that Kemi Badenoch is working out how to survive another year as leader, while her colleagues privately whisper about whether she can. And I'll have more on that muttering too. No, I'm talking about the mind-boggling fact that the Conservative Party, the oldest, the most successful party in the democratic world, may be looking down the barrel of political extinction. And today, and this week in Manchester, the Tories are facing that momentous possibility, even if most of them are trying not to. Now, on today's programme, I'll have for you the latest news and reaction to the Conservative proposals to slash public spending, to promise deep, deep cuts in welfare, to deport migrants by the tens of thousands. And it's only Monday. And would it be nearly enough by Wednesday, when Kemi Badenoch delivers her big speech, to slow down the march of Nigel Farage and Reform UK, who's now talking optimistically of taking a turn in government and driving the Tories towards political oblivion on the way? I wonder what you're thinking. Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. First, though, a potentially, and I stress potentially, world-changing event that's happening now. Delegations from Israel, from Hamas, and from the USA are meeting in Egypt to thrash out what America is calling the details of a peace deal in Gaza. Let's talk about that meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh. Benoit Fossa is the Wall Street Journal's Middle East correspondent, and he's live on the line. Welcome to you, Benoit.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here, Benoit. I want to really keen to get your thoughts on these talks in Egypt. But before we come to those, what do you make of the fact, Benoit, that Donald Trump demanded an immediate halt to the Israeli strikes in Gaza, but they continued?
I mean, that's a complicated one, because obviously Donald Trump already had to manage the liability of, you know, the Israeli strikes in Doha. He managed, you know, sort of to get everyone on the same side, which is, you know, get, you know, Israel to apologize and sort of repair effectively any damage that would have been made for future negotiation and you know, help them restart. But like you say, there's now another liability, which is talks have started in practice while, you know, the strikes continue and the operations continue. I mean, functionally, there is no ceasefire. There is a negotiation towards a ceasefire, but until the hostages are released, you know, for Netanyahu, as far as he's concerned, we're still in the phase to discuss the ceasefire and the terms of that ceasefire, not in the moment where the fighting would stop.
Okay, now just a word about the talks then. I mean, to talk about, well, I spoke about the potential for a peace deal for good reason. And when you hear the White House talking about ironing out details, Benoit, that rather glosses over the many ways these talks could still founder.
Absolutely. I mean, we're really in negotiations. We have a proposal. You know, every side has effectively said we're ready to discuss it. But I mean, look at the blanks, for instance, you know. What would happen to Hamas light weapons, for instance? That's not agreed at all. That's a key fundamental.